This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Lessons from day one and the first part of day two of the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings in the Senate for the Supreme Court, plus another 10-term Democratic congressman falls in a primary. And Rahm Emanuel, mayor of Chicago, decides he's not going to run for a third term. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, and we will be talking about these subjects with my colleagues at the Wall Street Journal, Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Paul.
And Kim Strassel. Hey, Kim.
Hey, Paul.
So the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, the big event in politics this week, the biggest event, and I guess after the drama, Kim, of yesterday's early session, which we now know was choreographed by the minority leader of the Senate, Chuck Schumer, to try to suggest that somehow the Republicans are covering up Brett Kavanaugh documents, we're getting down to a more normal Q&A on a variety of subjects. And what's your takeaway so far?
Well, takeaway so far, yes, we've moved on to questions, and Brett Kavanaugh has sat through now about four or five senators asking him questions. It's what you would expect. You have Democrats on the committee who have been attempting to get him to provide what his legal views would be on hypothetical cases, on everything from ranging from, can a president pardon himself, for instance, and how do you look at Roe v. Wade? He's not falling for that. It has been typical of Supreme Court nominees for years now to say that it isn't appropriate to comment on how they would rule on a case in the future with a set of facts that they haven't yet seen. There was one gotcha or attempted gotcha moment. Senator Leahy tried to dig up a flap from about 15 years ago that involved a Republican staffer taking information from a Democratic server on the Judiciary Committee, suggesting that Brett Kavanaugh might have known about this, quote, stolen information. But in general, Kavanaugh has weathered this very well. He looks relaxed up there and is fielding broad philosophical questions about legal points, but not getting roped into any specifics.
Bill, the rule is known as the Ginsburg Rule, after Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the liberal justice on the Supreme Court, in her confirmation hearing, stipulated that it would be untoward, improper for her to suggest just how she would rule on specific cases, and in particular on close constitutional questions that could be indicative of how she might rule on cases. And every justice, potential justice, candidate for the position, nominee, has abided by that. So that's not surprising at all that Kavanaugh would as well.
No, and he's been through it before as a White House staffer with Sam Alito and John Roberts on the murder boards, probably asked some of the questions himself. So, I mean, if you had to pick of that list of qualified people who could be nominees for the Supreme Court, knowing Brett Kavanaugh, he just is probably the most bulletproof in the sense of being prepared for testimony. But I will say it's sad because since Bork, I think we've written several times that the Supreme Court has become basically the Democrats' preferred legislature, right? It's a lot easier to get the fifth vote on the Supreme Court for your legislation that you can't get through all 50 legislatures in the state or through Congress. And so it's sad that it's so outcome oriented, because I think judicial philosophy is interesting and it would be illuminating to know. And if you look at any of the pre-Bork hearings, I'm thinking particularly of Scalia, it's incredible how expansive he was on how he approached the Constitution. That's just interesting. So it's a loss, I think, for the American people. We seem to be focused on everything except judicial philosophy, and which is why his own opinions, what is it, 300 or so?
Yeah, 307, 30, I think.
No one seems interested in. I think that's a loss for the process.
Judge Bork, Robert Bork, we all knew personally. Well, maybe you didn't, Kim, because he came along before your time. But
not me, no.
Yeah, I knew him personally, and he was. He had said, remember the famous answer? He said, well, what do you think about the Supreme Court? And he called it, I think, an intellectual feast.
Right.
And because it was, you know, he was an intellectual, one of the leading lights of the law in his time. And that was somehow taken as a sign that he was bloodless.
Right. It was used against him.
Yeah.
And I mean, the other part of this, which, again, I think our editorials have explored, I think to the left, John Roberts, Sam Alito, Scalia, Brett Kavanaugh all look the same, right? Because they sort of broadly support a view of the Constitution that's fairly originalist and so forth. But there are a lot of differences within that world. And I think it's fair to say even in Justice Scalia, I mean, he was my sort of beau ideal of a Supreme Court justice. But a couple of things, I'm not sure he was quite right on the administrative state early on, but I think he was changing at the end. And I think someone like Brett Kavanaugh, who's definitely in this position, I mean, his writings on the separation of powers as the core of our liberty is very Scalian in this. But I think he's more hostile to the administrative state than maybe Justice Scalia was.
I think that's correct, Bill. The star of the show so far, Kim, in my view, Ben Sasse, Nebraska senator, who in his opening statement gave a stemwinder of an opening statement saying, first starting off by saying the attacks on Kavanaugh have really nothing to do with Kavanaugh. They don't describe anything truthful about Kavanaugh. But they do reflect the failure of Congress. And here was his logic, which was fascinating. He said the reason that people are saying these things about Kavanaugh, that they're not true, is because we put so much such a high stake on who becomes a Supreme Court justice now. And one of the reasons we do, he said, is because the Congress of the United States, where the locus of political competition and the competition of ideas ought to be, certainly that's the way the framers understood it, has abdicated its responsibility by writing vast laws with unspecific terms that then the bureaucracy and the administrative state, the executive branch, some bureaucracy somewhere, then actually puts into practice in specific cases and specific rules and guidance. And that's what the American people have to live with. And therefore, when somebody in Nebraska, as he put it, their life made very difficult by these rules, where do they go? They can't vote out the bureaucracy. They can't vote out the land manager from the Bureau of Mines, for example. So you end up with the Supreme Court being the place where people get to redress their grievances. And that's an enormous burden to put on the court, and it's one of the reasons that it now has become the locus of so much political debate.
Yeah, I think something that's been amid this circus that is the Kavanaugh hearing, something that has been refreshing is that a couple of the Republicans have used their time both yesterday and today to step back and say, how did we get here? How do we get to the point where you can have this man sitting in front of us who is undoubtedly supremely qualified, and we are nonetheless going back and forth over whether or not he deserves a place on the Supreme Court? And Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina just did this in his own minutes, and he pointed out, for instance, that if you go back and you look at the nominations of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia, two judges with incredibly different philosophies about the judiciary and the way they approach opinions, they both of them got close to unanimous support in the Senate when they were put forward in the high 90s in terms of the numbers of senators who voted for them.
I think Scalia was 100. I think it was 100 to nothing.
And then you go up to Sotomayor and Kagan, President Obama's nominees, and both of them got in the 60s, much lower, although still a number of crossovers. And Senator Graham noted that he has voted for every Supreme Court nominee because he expects that a president that has a party different than his own is going to appoint a nominee with a different judicial philosophy, the question is qualifications. And that goes back to Ben Sasse, who was just the star yesterday. And he tried to explain how we got to this position. And it's just as you said, that Congress, he says, doesn't want to do its work. And so they punt their legislative work to the next branch. And the executive branch has been more than willing to fill that gap and make up rules as it goes along. And then the Supreme Court has to be the referee. And so these nominees have just become cases of political football. And of course, his answer is, if you want to fix this, and you can obviously see this coming, is Congress needs to do its job. And then the Supreme Court can once again be put in a role of actually being just more of a referee.
All right. We're talking about Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation hearings, also an upset in a Democratic primary in Massachusetts, and Rahm Emanuel bows out. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
You can now listen to Potomac Watch on your Amazon smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal. From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. And let's turn to another upset of a 10-term Democratic congressman, this time Michael Capuano of Massachusetts, Boston, 7th District, longtime liberal, a very liberal voting record, 66 years old, upset by Ayanna Pressley on Tuesday, a 44-year-old African-American woman, Boston City Councilwoman, and not just defeated, I mean blown away, 58.6% of the vote for Pressley. And Capuano was not caught by surprise. He knew he had a hard race on his hands. Pressley is not a newcomer to politics. She's been around a while. She had an endorsement from the Attorney General of Massachusetts. But Capuano's an old pro too, and this echoed of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's defeat a couple of months back of Joe Crowley of Queens, another 10-term white Democratic congressman, war horse. So you're going to have two younger minority women, left of center, strongly left of center progressives in the House of Representatives, Bill.
Yeah, look, I think as you pointed out, there are a lot more dissimilarities with the New York race. Both the incumbent and the challenger were far more established Democrats than we saw in New York. A lot of differences. Also, the incumbent in Massachusetts was far more liberal, was closer to Ocasio-Cortez in his record and so forth. But what you do see in common is incumbent white male Democrats defeated by female people of color, right, in both things. And that's sort of the logic of identity politics. If you really believe it, as many in the Democratic Party do, it's hard to see why in a district such as Massachusetts, which I believe is majority minority, right, voters, why
58% of
why it should be
district.
Why it should be represented by a white male Democrat. And I suspect he's not going to be the last that that goes.
Kim, the question will be, Democrats, by most accounts, poised to take over the House of Representatives, pick up the 23 seats they need. It's not a done deal, obviously, but I think most of the betting odds put them at odds of 70%, 60-70%. I'd say closer to 70 or higher that they'll take over the House. And so these will be these two representatives, and Ayanna Pressley will be in the majority. What does that do to the dynamics within the Democratic majority? And I should say, neither of them said they won't vote for Nancy Pelosi. These are a couple of votes for Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, well, that you just hit on the main question that answers that is how do these people then influence the leadership of the Democratic Party? There's obviously been a lot of people that have expressed some concern about how long Nancy Pelosi has been there, the general age of that leadership team, and a push for a younger generation. And one thing that I thought was really interesting about that Massachusetts 7 race and this upset is that both of those candidates agreed that there was hardly any difference between them on policy questions. Mike Capuano and Ayanna Pressley were both super progressives. This is one of the most liberal districts in Massachusetts, if not the most liberal district, and that makes it one of the most liberal districts in the country. And But Ayanna Pressley's motto for this slogan for her campaign was change can't wait. And there seemed to be a very anti-incumbent mood that drove her victory. And the question is, does that get transferred back by this generation of ascendant progressives who are going to land in Congress and force that kind of change among Nancy Pelosi and the leadership? If they do, they're going to have a lot more power and control over the agenda of the party. But in general, there is still going to be a tension because across some of the other parts of the country, the way the Democrats are winning these controversial races is to put forward, at least on paper, more, quote, moderate conservative Democrats. And that is going to be a split in the party when they get there. We'll see who wrests control of the leadership mantle.
Safe to say we have two votes for impeachment in these two women. Anyway, let's turn to Rahm Emanuel. Briefly, Rahm Emanuel is now in his second term as mayor of Chicago, the former White House chief of staff, former congressman, architect in many ways of the Democratic House takeover in 2006 by nominating moderates, pushing moderates in the swing districts. Now, second term mayor has, I think, done some good things for Chicago. And this decision surprises me a bit because I had breakfast with the mayor a couple of months ago, and he seemed very eager to talk about his record, very eager to talk about his plans for the future of Chicago. He's been pressing ahead on most fronts, and yet he may have seen, Bill, that there was trouble ahead given the desire for change within the Democratic Party. And he was not going to have an easy election run.
Yeah. Also, I think Chicago's a disaster. I think that's putting it kindly. I think businesses are fleeing. The schools are terrible. He lost his battle with the unions. To his credit, he tried to institute some reforms. And the crime is just out of control. And I think he's looking ahead. And does he want to do that? Now, unfortunately, the likelihood of Democratic politics in Chicago is that most of the candidates would be worse, right? The candidates who are likely to win would be worse. But I don't think Chicago's a model for anyone. I mean, look at the shootings this past weekend.
Yeah, Bill, I'm going to disagree with you here at least in a couple of ways. One is on the schools. I think Emanuel actually improved the schools. He did so by raising standards and pushing charters. Now, the finances in the schools are a catastrophe thanks to pensions and so on. He did a bad deal with the union to get reelected the first time, with a huge pay raise and not doing anything about pensions. But part of the problem with Chicago pensions, he needs help from Illinois and the state, and he didn't get it. Second thing, on the crime business, I agree with you. He has been a problem, and he has not led the way he should have. But Chicago is not a crime-ridden city. It is in particular minority neighborhoods.
Is that a plus that the crime's in a minority area?
It's terrible, but for what it is, what I'm saying is, you said the murders, in fact, you do need to address them, and he should have done a better job. But it's not as if you're going to be shot walking down the streets in most of Chicago. That's my point.
Yeah, I'm just not sure that's a defense that only minorities in Chicago have to worry about getting shot.
No. It's in the high crime, gang ridden district.
Right,
that's
but
my
he didn't
point.
Do anything. He suppressed a police tape of a bad shooting until after. I'm just saying, I'm not sure anyone would point to Chicago as a place that's working. It used to be the city that works, and I think the business climate is terrible. You know, they're having a hard time keeping people there. Again, I think all the likely successors will be worse. There's no viable Republican as there have been in other cities like New York. So I feel bad for Chicago.
Kim, you have a thought?
Well, look, Chicago is just a tough place to be a politician because, I mean, we got to remember, this is a city that is just rife with its own type of corruption. It's a tricky place to navigate as a politician, even if you have an intention to do some good. And I agree. I think Rahm Emanuel, look, it's a different job to be the head of a city. You're dealing with a particular set of issues. And on some of those, I think he did do better. Like you said, Paul, graduation rates are up there. That's a good thing. Some of the school metrics are up. So there's got new companies downtown, which has been helpful. There's been an expansion. Planned expansion for O'Hare Airport, which is overdue. So he's accomplished some things. But if you look, he's just been surrounded these past years by the kind of scandals that just seem to be typical these days of dysfunctional big cities. They had the federal investigation of the police department and now court-ordered changes to its practices, school closings, teacher strikes. There was a corruption conviction of his school's chief. There was a sex abuse scandal in the Chicago public schools, record tax increases to take care of failing pension plans. All of this was going to be brought up against him because when you do try to affect change in a place like that, you make a lot of enemies. There were already 12 challengers in the race to run against him. And I think that the mayor just decided that he was not necessarily ready to go through the enormous effort it was going to take to get through a reelection. He probably would have won, but it would have been a pretty grueling experience.
I think it's a trend. His successor, it's going to be interesting to watch because, as you've seen in New York and in San Francisco, in New York with Mayor de Blasio, you're seeing a move towards the left and the progressive left inside the Democratic Party in the coalitions with public unions becoming the dominant political force in these cities. And that means a left turn that is not going to improve the finances anytime soon. Is not going to it could see after 2-3 decades of improvement in crime a deterioration. And as we've seen, and I think one of my fears in Chicago would be that the progress that Emanuel has made on school reform, total by any means, but the progress he has made will be rolled back if you get a union-backed mayor in that city.
It's not only the unions. I mean, in fairness to Rahm, also there are various school initiatives in the capital that were partly defeated by, I mean, partly the teachers' unions, but partly the suburban Republicans who didn't want Chicago kids in their schools and so forth.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back again later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.